Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back. I'm Timothy Maurice, and this is Unbranded. And I'm thrilled today to bring you sort of a pioneering look at why sex still sells and how brands are incorporating it into their strategy. If you look at the history of this conversation, we're going to explore this from literally the 1800s when brands sort of came about. And we're going to look at, are brands being lazy? Is there more we can do that is a bit more conscious? Or is it just okay? Are we wired this way? Are we wired to really sort of leverage our sort of lower primitive instincts? And that's just how it is. Again, I'm Timothy Maurice. I'm four-time best-selling author. I'm thrilled to let you know that my new book, PBQ, Personal Brand Intelligence, just hit the bestseller list at Exclusive Books. So I'm thrilled about that. And, you know, today I decided to have this conversation because I'm finding it fascinating, from politics to the corporate world to even NGOs. People use sex to sell, and it doesn't seem to be changing. But is there a higher, more conscious way to approach this? Or is that just sort of ridiculous thinking? So you can send me your ideas and your thoughts on if brands sort of exploit particularly women. Is the objectifying of women an issue that really, really bothers you? And, you know, feel free again to join this conversation. You can tweet us at CliffCentral.com, or you can tweet me at Timothy Maurice, M-A-U-R-I-C-E. You can always hit us up on WeChat, Cliff Central, Facebook, Cliff Central as well, and join the conversation. So, you know, this is a show that explores the sort of connection between human and brand behavior. And it's a topic that I'm absolutely in love with. If you look all the way to the left, you've got this whole notion of human behavior. If you look at all the way to the right, you've got brand behavior. And in the middle, there's this idea that I want to put out thoughts and principles that get you to sort of see how they work together. And today's topic particularly intrigued me because as I've been sort of scouring and sort of looking at the connection between human and brand behavior, I've noticed that this sort of sex sells is getting more intense. At some point, a few years ago, I thought the tide was changing, but it doesn't seem to be changing. So, do people really buy a product just because it has sexually stimulating imagery attached to it? Maybe you can answer that for yourself. Have you ever bought something? Have you ever purchased something just because? Or was it they triggered your subconscious mind and you bought it and you didn't even realize it? If you stay tuned throughout the show, you will see that you may think completely differently. And I want you to be more conscious and aware as you go about engaging and consuming items. So this underlying pre-programmed disposition to respond to sexual imagery is so strong, it has been used for over 100 years in advertising. And the industry, while abusing it more and more, would be foolish to ignore the draw of sexual and erotic messaging. How does using sex and the brain work in advertising? And, you know, for me, that's the question for today. What is the link? How strong is that link? And can we unpack it and really sort of rechannel our thoughts around it and come up with some new innovative models? So the first part of the show, we're going to really talk about that link. Second part of the show, I'm going to really give you some examples from the history of how sex has been used to sell. I'm going to give you some good examples and some poor examples. And by the end of the show, I'm going to talk about, if you want to do this in a very sort of clever way, I'm going to give you some ideas about how to actually go about doing it as well. So stay tuned over the next sort of probably about 45 minutes. Up at the end of the show, as you know, we have our cyber health feature with Rhea Nett. She's going to come in and chat to you about how to sort of thrive online when it comes to your cyber online engagement through our cyber health feature. So I'm going to play a quick song quickly, and we're going to come back and we're going to dig in to why sex sells.
I'm Hungarian, Nikki BB eating Diamond Fangs Barbarian.
Yo, like MJ Doctor, they killing me. Propofol, I know they hope I fall, but tell them winning is my mother.
Sex sells. Brands are still using sex to sell at an alarming rate, or is it alarming? Is it just part of our human nature? Is it Will this be with us forever? I'm Timothy Maurice, and this is Unbranded, and we're chatting today about why sex sells. If you go to any newsroom anywhere in the world, you will hear two things. Sex sells, and if it bleeds, it leads. That's why you see CNN pouncing you over the head with negative images. They replay or have on loop over and over and over. Gunshots and people getting killed and over, and we're addicted to it. Our sort of deeper primal instincts, we are very animalistic, and so violence and sex, we are drawn to the deeper human drivers. We're really drawn to this sort of space. If you look at phenomenons like Kim Kardashian was just on the cover of Forbes magazine about how she's become a mobile maven. But at the end of the day, if you look at sort of Kim's features, you look at her body proportions, she has what many scientists argue sort of the ideal proportions to sort of draw the mind in and consider from a subconscious level her ability to be able to nurture a child. And so ultimately her image and her body represents and mirrors the subconscious mind's ideal when it comes to sort of being able to carry a child. So these proportions inspire us to be zoomed in on the subconscious level. So what's really important about this conversation is that sex doesn't just sell because we are slow, we're not thinking people. It's because it taps into something much deeper, something much more primal. And so we're going to chat about these sort of basic fundamental instincts and how the advertising and branding industry leverages these. Please share your thoughts on Twitter, Facebook. You can hit me up directly at Timothy Maurice, M-A-U-R-I-C-E. And as I said before we went to the break, we'll at the end of the show, we'll have Rianette chatting about cyber health. So, typically sex refers to beautiful women and, of course, handsome men that are used to lure in the viewer, reader, or listener, despite a tenuous and non-existent link. Sometimes, for example, you'll look and there's a link between a woman, you know, on a computer magazine. It's pretty ridiculous. Seems no link, but studies show that people will buy more copies of the magazine if there is a woman with a bikini on versus, you know, a dude actually on his computer or a woman on the computer. So, and let's talk about why this is the case. Are we lazy or are we just simple? What is it? So we have this thing called sort of the lizard brain in our subconscious mind. And in terms of evolution, it is the oldest part of our brain and is responsible for survival. It pays attention to three things only: food, danger, and sex. Violence. Our need to survive when it comes to food and sex. And for the most part, I mean, most people are quite sexual. There are asexual people out there. There are different types of people out there who don't even enjoy sex at all. And we're not going to talk about sex in that way. We have a sex show. So please tune in to the sex show on Friday morning. This is about how sex is leveraged to grow sort of brands. So even though our lizard brain operates on a subconscious level, and so we are not aware of its presence, it's continually working, scanning environments in search of things that can endanger you, things that you could eat and things that you could have sex with. So essentially, we are constantly observing the environment on a subconscious level. You're not doing this consciously, but on a subconscious level, you're perusing your environment and trying to decide what is it that I could potentially mate with to sort of extend my DNA or my legacy. Now, this is a very sort of controversial thing, but this is very, very powerful. And this is why using sex in advertising is so powerful. Whenever a person is exposed to a sexual message, their old brain, or that lizard brain, gets activated. And the second that that happens, the old brain takes over and it becomes extremely focused on that particular image. So people argue that men are more visual when it comes to sexual imagery than women, but women are also extremely visual as well. It's about a question of degree. We are strongly wired to react to sex. You can see it. It's like whether you can see the lizard brain in action whenever there's an accident on the side of the road. People pull up to it and they want to see, is there any violent, gory thing that's happened? Or if someone is fighting, people will stop everything they're doing and walk over and just watch this thing. We are voyeurs when it comes to this. If you've ever been to a nude beach, I have been to a nude beach. It's fascinating because, you know, nude beaches in the morning are very asexual. There's not much sexuality and sensuality happening. But after 5 o'clock, when the sort of the sun starts to go down, the energy changes. And, you know, I try not to stay past that time, but I have before. And if you see, you'll see people behind rocks starting to become intimate. And if they're having sex, it's kind of hard to turn your head. It's a weird, sort of feeling, that we're sort of subconsciously sort of wired to sort of experience this. And there's a lot of deeper reasons why this is the case, and we can have a whole nother show on this. But, ultimately, it's so strong that we respond to messages that only imply sex. You don't need to use pictures of fully naked models in your ads. Showing an ankle or a neck or the erogenous zones will work just as effectively. However, we are entering an age where sex can be an extraordinary turnoff for a lot of consumers. I mean, there are cases, for example, when it came to Abercrombie and Fitch, where their over usage of sex really sort of just put people off in such a way that it, you know, literally started to kill their business. You know, Dolce & Gabbana, for example, famous for its sexual ads and association with a deeply sexual look, rolled out a campaign in 2007 where people just felt it just went too far, where they felt that women were being objectified, that there were scenes that looked like rape, and women were being dominated. And obviously there was attention brought to it, but there was a huge uproar to such an extent that Dolce & Gabbana had to sort of reevaluate their entire approach. And if you look, they've evolved and they've become almost like a family brand. The majority of their imaging and messages and their campaigns are speaking towards legacy instead of just using the sort of sex. So they're a great example of a brand that can start to explore and sort of think more consciously. I'm fascinated with brands like Tom Ford, who, while they use a lot of hypersexuality in their campaigns, they also are able to sort of bridge this dynamic sort of fairly well. Brands like H&M, relatively new to South Africa's shores, have really done well using brand personalities and influences like David Beckham. Calvin Klein is a major pioneer when it comes to this as well, using sort of sexuality. But in the case of Calvin Klein and H&M, it makes more sense because it's sort of a natural sort of organic link. Let's go back to where it sort of all began. Where did this thing really all begin? The earliest known use of sex in advertising dates back to 1871, when the Pearl Tobacco Company featured a naked maiden on the package cover. In fact, the first brands to enter this trend were saloons, tonics, and tobacco. That was 1871. Why would they use a naked woman on the cover of a cigarette package? Precisely because at the time, women were not smoking, and it was seen as very taboo for women to smoke. So what they did was they wanted it to appear sexy and sort of appeal to sort of the subconscious sort of dynamic that we have, where all of us sort of want to be, you know, noticed and sort of appear to be relevant in our societies and so forth. And then in 1885, W. Duke and Sons, a manufacturer of facial soap, they actually included trading cards in the soap's packaging that included erotic images of the day's most popular female stars. This is 1885. And the link between soap and sex is very, very weak. Although some people, you know, they have sex in the shower. But at the end of the day, that was a very sort of weak link. But it worked. And it worked extremely well. If you fast forward to the 1970s, the hair dye Clairol by Procter & Gamble launched this famous campaign under the ambiguous slogan, "Does she or doesn't she? Only our hairdresser knows for sure." Now, this campaign was major. I remember back in the States, it was huge. extremely, extremely, extremely popular. And what's really fascinating about the way they are able to do that was that, you know, at that time, that was sort of the, you know, the liberal movement that really was taken off. That sort of hipster movement had sort of, the hippie movement was taken off in a way where they had the world's attention. So oftentimes, being able to use sex in your campaigns, you must be very, very clear of what's going on in your environment and how do you tap into what's happening in the greater sort of social psyche. Another example is the National Airlines Fly Me campaign, featuring stewardess saying, "I'm Cheryl, fly me." Now, what's really interesting about how this worked was that the national passengers increased by 23%, twice that of any other airline. But the question is it sustainable? Is it possible to continue with these type of campaigns and not tire and fatigue and bore your consumers? That's still very, very questionable. If you've seen a brand that's been able to sustain this, let me know. But for the most part, what I've witnessed is that this is not sustainable. So in cases like Dolce & Gabbana, they've really been able to sort of pioneer out of just that sort of one-dimensional sort of messaging and really reach to a higher level of engagement. And ultimately, consumers are human. They will respond. But they're also smart, well-educated people who will soon realize that they are being manipulated. And that's the key. Whether it is a community like Cliff Central, who, when we came out of the box, you know, we were very, very sort of vocal about our sort of more controversial shows, sharing and strategically positioning some of the more controversial shows to sort of get your attention. But ultimately, as we settle in and the brand sort of solidifies and grows, and, you know, we're able to sort of share across the board. And if you're interested in the sexual stuff, great. If you're interested in the more conscious sort of stuff, great. But at the end of the day, it's about knowing that we are subconsciously wired. When we come back after the break, I'm going to give you a couple more examples of some fascinating campaigns, from cars to phones to all types of brands that being able to do this. And then we're going to chat a bit about how you can incorporate it into your strategy as well. We'll be right back.
Cliff Central.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com. Download the Cliff Central app, available now on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store.
I am a South African. I carry the hopes and dreams of my country and the generations to come. I know that it's not where I come from, but where I'm going to that really matters.
At Sibanye, we believe the future of our country will be defined by our actions today, which is why we are committed to the development of our leaders. Sibanye, we are one. Visit us on sibanyegold.co.za.
Attention all young leaders. Ever wondered how to go from where you are to where you want to be? It's time to take charge of your future. The Unplugged and In Charge radio show is hosting the second annual Young Leaders Seminar. It's a seminar that's relevant to the youth, original, fun, creative, and so not old-fashioned. The Young Leaders Seminar looks to bring together some of the freshest game changers and inspirational celebrity guests. Join us on the 22nd of July at 6 p.m. at the Museion Theatre of University of Pretoria. The power lineup includes Gareth Cliff, Subin Boya, the host of the Unplugged and In Charge radio show, and a few surprise celebrity guests. Get your ticket at CompuTicket for 100 Rand and get trending on hashtag YLS2016. The Young Leader Seminar, brought to you by Unplugged and In Charge NPO, in association with CliffCentral.com. Because we are the ones we've been waiting for.
Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.
Again, I am Timothy Maurice, and this is Unbranded, and we're talking why sex sells and what is it about human nature that really sort of drives us to be interested in this. Before the break, we talked about our sort of lower primitive lizard brain that is interested in sort of food, sex, and sort of survival sort of instincts. And some brands like this sort of airline who use this sort of sex sells campaign, the Fly Me campaign, featuring stewardess going, "I'm Cheryl, fly me," and how they grew their sort of revenue by 23%, twice that of any other airline. And we also talked about brands like Dolce & Gabbana, who got themselves in a lot of trouble in 2007, and how they have been able to sort of shift and pioneer their brand to a family brand and showing sort of generational sort of legacy dynamics, and how that's really sort of worked well for them in such an extraordinary way that they have sort of gained additional revenue channels by sort of thinking beyond sex. So, you know, this sort of show, I really wanted to have it particularly to inspire you to think about, if you want to use this strategy, what's the best way to do it? And if you want to evolve past just a sex sales narrative, what is the best way to do it? So, you know, our goal to pursue the link between human and brand behavior is really to do just what we're doing today, to explore that extraordinary link. Volkswagen, depends on how you say it, is a car that's been able to sort of, a German brand that's been able to do and experiment with sex and advertising and be very daring. You've seen the ad for the Beetle, the one that sort of promotes new brake system in its cars. What's fascinating about it is there is no car in the ad. All you can see is a half-naked woman in the window. Cars have been associated with sex for better sales for many, many years. Cars always use it. I think it's something about the motor and the engine and that sort of raw sort of, you know, nature that sort of gets people sort of wound up. It's one of the products that easily link to sort of the erotic side of the messaging. Producers want their cars to be perceived as sexy, fast, daring. And so most of the advertising uses sex with, they work fairly well, but again, I think cars are being slightly lazy as well. There's a new level. If you guys remember way back when sort of Motorola phones, the flip phones were hot. Remember the one with Megan Fox? She was in a bath. Motorola takes a more sensual approach to its advertising. Though the focus is taken away from the phone itself, it does a good job at presenting phone features in a humorous way. And I think that's the key. So that you don't underestimate the intelligence of the consumer, you've got to add additional angles of sort of, you know, fun and enlightenment so that you don't sort of pounce on them on the subconscious lizard side and ignore the sort of conscious thinking side of the brain. That's very, very important. But just as sort of Motorola could not sustain this, the consumer needs real tangible benefits. You can't just sell people sex over and over. At some stage, people evolve and they want to know that you are evolving with them. I want to just sort of shift a bit and talk a little bit of strategy. If you're interested in using this sort of approach, how do you link the sort of tendency for the lizard brain to be able to drive your ultimate goals? What's really interesting right now, if you're listening this during the time of the sort of Republican convention, it's really fascinating to see Donald Trump almost sort of leverage his wife's sort of sensuality in a way that getting ahead. Most people would argue that this was a sort of a liability and a weakness in his campaign. But what he's been able to do is show that his woman, his wife, has a lot of vitality. He's showing her in a way, in a very sort of strategic way. Just last night, she did a speech and she focused far more on the sort of the family side of who she is and the hard work and what she was taught as a kid. But it's quite obvious that she's used sort of as a symbol of, you know, America's sort of make America great again, make America beautiful again, make America thriving again. And they're doing it very, very subtly in a very sort of smart way. And to think that she could be the first lady that whoever posed nude is really fascinating. Michelle Obama was the first lady with two Ivy League degrees, which is a fundamentally different sort of dynamic. But anyway, Melania Trump does have a degree. She graduated from a university in Slovenia in sort of a design and architecture, which I thought was really interesting. So she's quite a smart woman, and people kind of sort of underestimate her because of her sex. If you feel like you're constantly underestimated because you have sort of a sexuality and an inherent sort of default sexuality, let us know. I find it interesting. I always find that sort of Mrs. South Africa's or people who are in the modeling industry always find it a challenge to transition from being seen as sort of a sex symbol to someone really serious. I've worked with clients before who try to sort of mute that side of them, who want to be taken more serious. I've seen actresses who have been typecast and they struggle to get more serious roles because they're seen as overtly sexy. There is a young woman who was in, her name is Emily. I can't even begin to pronounce her surname, but she was in the Blurred Lines video. Emily regrets that video. And she has been on record to say that it has sort of limited her career choices because all people want to do is see her boobs now. And this is one of the sad things about this dynamic, is that it boxes women in such a way that it really, they really sort of struggle to get out of it. I found very few men that struggle to make that sort of contrast or that sort of shift. If you look at people like David Beckham, David Beckham shows himself fairly nude in an underwear ad, and then tomorrow he decides to go package himself as a power player in a boardroom, I doubt very, very many people would struggle to allow him to make that shift, whereas women often get boxed. So this is really important. But let's talk about a little bit about the how to leverage and target the lizard brain. So you are going to be fighting a losing battle if you try and fit a square peg in a round hole. This is sort of an obvious thing, but let's explore a little bit deeper so I can unpack what we're talking about. You cannot make someone react to a mundane product with a life-threatening message. A ridiculous example would be, quick, buy this sofa or you'll die. Unless, of course, you're being sarcastic. But in that case, you're asking people to use their neocortex or the limbic system, not the old lizard brain. Now, I want to unpack this a bit because this is extremely important. You can specifically target aggression, dominance, territoriality, ritualistic displays, and instinct. It all depends on the product or service you're selling and how you go about it. A shock in the system is one way to approach the lizard brain. You know, comedians use this contrast. Filmmakers use this contrast all the time. They basically take you from one scenario of sort of a bland sort of example, and they contrast dramatically in the next moment to go between your sort of higher region, the cortex of the brain, and your lower limbic system quickly. And when that happens, they jerk you into that moment, and now they have your attention. You're locked in. So the shock to the system is one way. So Volkswagen did this beautifully with their Safe Happens campaign, which we mentioned earlier, which violently and abruptly shocks the viewer into seeing a safety message. Now, you can use this with your own sort of personal brand as well. You can use contrast on Instagram. You can use contrast on Twitter. You can use contrast across the board. You can do videos where on one level of the video, you have an example where, for example, you focus on a clock. The next moment you are showing yourself in a bikini, and the next moment you're showing a sort of a deep message. Now, when you do this, you move in and you're toying with the mind of your viewer, and you get them to sort of engage and sort of lock in. And if you use and you slow down the video and then you increase the pace of the video, you physically are controlling people's minds. And that's the beauty of this. You know, beyond the sort of downsides and so forth, the beauty of it is you physically can employ these tools to actually sort of control. You just want to do it in a responsible way. So political ads do this all the time. They're not trying to appeal to the rational side. They want to poke and prod the lizard brain to get you feeling angry and outdated. That is the success of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is basically saying to America that if you don't vote me in, the world is going to blow us up. Obama is incompetent. Hillary Clinton can't be trusted. And ultimately, if you don't vote me in, these incompetent people who, you know, are ruining our country are going to make a third world. So the idea is that he is prodding and poking the sort of lower regions of the brain, the sort of fear mechanism that we are wired to have inside of us. And he's doing it to such a way that he went from being an absolute joke to being someone who could actually be president. Now, other politicians have continued to sort of play this sort of political game and not realize that we're in a new political era. It's interesting that locally the DA is starting to do the same thing. I saw recently where they said if you vote the EFF in, this will be Zimbabwe. Now, that sort of fear mongering and so forth really works with a lot of people who are terrified. If they've been able to associate a particular pattern in society and they've been able to see that things are going a particular direction, if you get on board with that and you understand and you recognize what's happening, it resonates with people. And I would say for anyone who is thinking of using sort of sex in your campaign, particularly in the South African region or any conservative region, you have to be really careful. South Africa is an extraordinarily conservative region of the world. And if you are going to employ tactics that don't consider this and you're not subtle and smart about it, you're going to really turn people off. If you're far too overt, I mean, we're not in France where these people see nudity on camera often, on TV often, so this is not sort of normal. But if you do it in a very sort of smart, subtle way, where you sort of tease people into engaging the brand, and you subtly show things, you're like, "Ooh, did I see a boob? Not really. Maybe. I'm not sure." That is a far more sophisticated way of getting people's attention. The same thing. I mean, South Africa experienced so much trauma and violence that being able to use sort of these sort of violent extremes in your ad, in your campaign, could really sort of turn people off and push them towards wanting to engage brands that are far more safe and sort of responsible. So I would suggest as you start thinking about incorporating this into your brand that you consider the context, consider what market and the segment of the market you're going after. Clearly, if you're looking for an older demographic, you got to be far more careful. If you're going after a younger demographic, you can be a bit more liberal and loose with your strategy and so forth. But at the end of the day, know the region that you're in. It is critical. The region that you're operating in and the people you're engaging is the biggest reason for whatever you're doing anyway. So make sure you do your research and that you're very clear about how you go about your strategy based on the sort of research. In a moment, we're going to shift to our cyber health feature with Rianette. I really enjoyed this sort of conversation because for me, you know, when I think about this idea of where brands are going and how brands are evolving, the one thing that I have noticed is that, you know, branding is a fairly new concept. If you look at disciplines like actuarial science, law field, legal fields, they are far more sort of old and they're very traditional. But branding is evolving and growing and it's moving fast. And you want to keep up with the trends and understand that, yes, there are certain things that are fundamental. There are certain sort of things you can leverage in sort of consumption patterns in humans' minds and understanding the lower regions. But you need to evolve and be far more creative when it comes to capturing the attention of a potential stakeholder. And you got to care about their needs and you got to be concerned about the fundamental reality of what they care about. Even if you look at people like the Kardashians and how they've been able to leverage sort of sex and how they've been able to leverage it in a way to be able to build, they have become really smart about not being too in people's face about sexuality and have been selling the family dynamic far more. And this, for me, is the brilliance in the Kardashian sort of brand, is that they've said, at the end of the day, we understand that you were initially attracted to us, but we need to build this bigger storyline about the family. We need to build you this bigger engagement about how our family is fairly normal, that we fight, that we have issues, we have concerns, we have fallouts and so forth, and that's what sustained the brand. So that's the key. If you get people's attention using these sort of shortcut methods, that's fine. But to sustain it, consider evolving the idea into sort of higher sort of value principles. That's how you're going to do it. I want to shift now to our cyber health feature. Rianette has joined us in studio, looking wonderful. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks, Tim. It's my son's birthday, so it started with a celebration, which is always nice.
Awesome.
Sounds like you're doing well.
I am doing well. I'm thrilled to be able to have this conversation and be able to engage. You know, when you're thinking about your feature and how people sort of engage the sort of cyber space, what's really, really important for me is to be thinking about that, yes, you can sell. And you've mentioned this before. You can sell sex to get people's attention, but it's very, very dangerous. And you could wind up really regretting it. There's people written books about it, and you want to be responsible. So that's the tone, and that is the whole messaging of sort of the cyber health philosophy, is to be focused, careful, and responsible about how you engage. So what do you have for us today?
Today I'm excited because I saw an article last week on the 14th of July, which I'm going to share details about, because, and I would like to invite people to grab a pen and paper or make sure that they can make notes, because it's really about what the apps that you've installed can see about you. And before we get there, I just want to say welcome. Thank you for joining us. I'm Maria Nett from Safety Net. It's wonderful to be here again. And just as a reminder, I mean, our mission is really to have cyber-savvy people online so that we can make use of the positive side of it. And Timothy is so right in saying that when we do use sex to sell, or when we do go beyond certain boundaries, it's just good to remember that it will be there forever if it's in cyberspace. So for today, before I get into the nuts and bolts of the app world, I would like to share some information about a new campaign that's launching, and I don't have a lot of information because it's only launching later this week. However, it's called #FreeYourself.
Okay.
And where this is where they, whoever they are getting people to question reality. And if you go to their website, they've got hashtags like Free Your Mind, Free Your Dreams, Free Your Actions. And one that I really like is Free Yourself from Others' Expectations. So I really look forward to sharing more information with you hopefully next week.
You can give us a little bit, nothing.
Nothing. Can't really, I can't give you anything else. But they are really doing a lot of activations around the country in South Africa, where they're getting people involved to take photos and experience all kinds of things. So
I look
forward to sharing more with you. So let's consider the apps that you've got on your phone. And I mean, recently a lot of attention has been given to this, but Rob Pegagaro, he is the contributing editor at yahoo.com. He wrote an article, and I would love to share it with you. The title is How to See If Your Apps Know Too Much About You. And I actually went through these steps that I'm going to share with you, and I was surprised, because even with me being very skeptical, and I really look carefully, I mean, I don't even use Facebook Messenger on my phone because it can access my database. So even for me, it was surprising to see which apps have access to my data.
Wow.
So
I'm going to go through this while you're going.
Okay, we're going to go through Facebook, Twitter. If there's time, we'll do LinkedIn. And we're going to start with Google. So we're going to log into our Google accounts. So the instant obsession over Pokemon Go, which is a whole different discussion for another day, hasn't just forced gamers to leave their homes and explore the outside world. Yay, they're getting fresh air. It's also yielded a teachable moment about privacy. After Niantic's smartphone game took off, Adam Reeve, principal architect at the Baltimore security analyst firm called Red Owl, saw something in his iOS version. His Google settings showed that signing into Pokemon Go with his Google account had given the game access to almost all of his Google account's information, from his email to his photos.
Wow.
Other security researchers, such as Trial of Bits, Dan Gudo, looked into this and confirmed that the game sought far more information than needed to verify the gamer's or the player's identity. Niantic said it wasn't reading anything more than Google's usernames or the Google usernames and email addresses, and quickly shipped an update to curb its access. Now, like Rob says, that developer did the right thing and commendably fast, but other companies with apps that invite you or require you to sign in via your Google or other social media account might not, and at worst could wind up being able to peek at parts of your online persona you want to keep private. So let's not take other apps or any apps that you install's word for it. Rather check what they access. And most of the time, you can untick some of the boxes. Let's start with Google.
Okay.
So if you want to go to Google, you check your you log into the site, and then at the top right-hand corner where your avatar is, yes, your picture, yes, you click there and you go to your account settings, my account. When you get there, you choose connected apps and sites to see which apps link to your account. And it's when you get there, you will see a list of apps that can see basic account information, and then there's more. But the basic account information only have access to parameters like your name, email, gender or country, which in itself is quite good research if you consider you're building an app and you want to, you know, localize the games, sure, and so forth. So this is fine as long as you remember granting that access and still use them. They should be okay. But carefully consider apps that can see more information than that, especially if they claim full access. That kind of access allows applicants or applications to see and modify nearly all information in your Google account.
Well, so, like I actually given up on Google. I just assume Google can do anything it wants. Like, in my mind, Google is so powerful, and they empower us so much. I just figured that if they want to come into my thing, change everything, actually shut down my phone, they probably can.
And do you like that thought, Tim?
No, but I don't know what to do.
So though, as Google points out, full access doesn't give them the apps the ability to change your password, delete your account, or pay with Google Wallet on your behalf. Thank goodness. Unfortunately, you can't partially revoke an app's permissions as you can in Android. So for example, you can't stop an app from reading your Google Plus profile if it can write to it now. It's all or nothing. So you either give them, you accept it and you give permission to the app, or you don't use the app.
Wow.
So then let's move on to Facebook.
Okay.
So when logged into the social network in a desktop browser, click the upside down triangle in the top right corner of the screen, and then you select settings. Now, this is where I got a fright, because some of these apps that had access to my Facebook settings, I don't even remember downloading them. So you go to your settings, then you click on apps in the toolbar to the left, and then you'll see all the apps and sites tapped into your account under logged in with Facebook. And then you click on each different app to see what data they can access and who can see your interaction with it. So you can limit who can see your interactions with apps so that only a subset of your friends or just yourself can see which American Express office you've claimed, for instance. This part I was quite surprised to see that they can see email addresses, the current city you're in, and obviously your public profile. That's one that you always give them access to. But just go through the list. You'll be quite surprised.
Wow. I'm going to do that now.
When, you know, it makes me wonder when they can see all my friends' details. And then I wonder how many of my friends have apps that share my personal details, and we think we're safe, but actually our friends are sharing our information without knowing.
Wow.
So Twitter, let's move on to the next one. Twitter, visit Twitter in a desktop browser and click again on your account icon in the top right corner of the screen and choose settings from the drop-down menu. And then you select the apps heading on the left side of the screen again. And the key thing to look for here is apps that have write access versus only being able to read your tweets and see your followers.
Okay.
Write access. Write as in WRIT, not you giving them the right. They can actually write. The only apps that can post tweets and get at your direct messages should be those you've installed to use Twitter. So remember, many times when you download an app, it says you want to log in via Twitter or with your Facebook account. And these are the ones we're talking about. You can't take away some of an app's permissions. So your sole resource, if one somewhat, you know, irks you, is the revoke access button. Then LinkedIn, just the last one, and I want to thank Rob, because there's not a lot of information on LinkedIn, but you need to go to click on your photo in the top right corner and select manage to the right of the privacy and settings heading, and then choose third parties on the left side.
Okay.
And then yeah, this is where you will see, you know, what other linkages there are. So it can be everything from email addresses to changing passwords and so forth. So just look under third parties. But I don't want to scare anyone. It's just good habits. Like,
you know, everyone listening is terrified right now.
So it's good habits for us. And these things are new. We didn't know about this 4 years ago. And apps were not so sophisticated that they could actually access all the data they do now.
But isn't that sort of the trade-off? Because we have these things for free, right? We have all this availability for free. Isn't that ultimately what the apps are saying? Like, look, if I'm going to give you this thing for free, you don't pay in anything. So I need access to something. I need to be able to make money from you.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, that is the trade-off. And if you're happy with it, I mean, by all means, go ahead. And, I mean, with Facebook Messenger, I'm sure it's, you know, it can't harm you. But being in the, you know, doing the work I do, I have to be more conscious of it. But, it's with anything in life, Timothy, we can become really paranoid, or let's just be savvy. That's what it's about. Let's be savvy. That's where safety net plays a role, because if you do make a mistake and you get into trouble or you don't know how to deal with a situation, we want people to contact us and let us help, whether it's a hacked profile or a someone being held ransom online and so forth. So I would like to invite you to please connect with us at Safety Net. It's SAVET Net, because we save lives by creating awareness for responsible digital engagement. Thank you very much, and have a safe journey online.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Rianette. And I suggest you go now, and particularly Google and those and Twitter, the ones you use the most. Check those first. Make those priority in terms of how you go about untagging and unlinking and all that types of stuff. So thank you so much for joining us today on Unbranded, as we explore this idea of why sex sells and why and how brands have been able to leverage our basic biological needs and issues and our human behavior. We really, really appreciate you tuning in. We thank you for downloading the podcast. And every time I meet someone on the street who says they are listening, I just absolutely, it makes my heart really sort of flutter. I really appreciate you tuning in. We'll see you next week with more Unbranded.
Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.